way they are and not accept the leaders. That's a very important point. Not only Sal mentioned that dyslexia is universal, this neural signature for dyslexia is universal as well. It's been found in every language that studied. Here is a little bit, this is an image from a colleague of ours, work, Raul Palacio, who works in the Italy. And Palacio studied groups of English, French, and Italian college students. And he compared dyslexic college students to their typical, to non-impaired peers. And here's the front of the brain and the back of the brain. And what he found is that this disruption, you see these big arms here, irregardless of the language, native language spoken, English, French, or Italian, the dyslexic reader had the same neural signature for dyslexia. Absolutely the same. More recently, other studies have found the very same instruction in dyslexia. And here's an image from a recent paper from Germany, where the investigators studied dyslexic German readers. And just look at this column here. Here are the fluent readers. You can see this front of the brain, the back of the brain, this large area, typical readers where there's activation. The dyslexic readers is much less. And if we compare fluent dyslexic readers, you can see the fluent readers are activating. You can just see here, a region here at the back of the brain. And so the same phenomenon, the same neural signature in every language study. So dyslexia is universal. Though there's a disruption of the neural systems of dyslexia, dyslexic readers try to compensate by developing other systems. This is a little bit of, this image is also in this is a cutaway view of the brain. We're looking at the left, here's the left side of the brain, and the typical readers have activation of the left side of the front of the brain, two regions in the back of the brain. Dyslexic reader has a disruption of these systems in the back of the brain, but the dyslexic reader tries to compensate by increasing activation in the left side of the front of the brain, also on the right side of the front of the brain and the right side of the back of the brain. Selling pointed out after the break that though the dyslexic reader tries to compensate, these compensatory systems just don't work as easily, as fluently as they do in typical readers. So while the dyslexic reader has developed these compensatory systems, it just not reading. We mentioned fluency, and we learned something about the neural systems of fluency. We learned that what we mean by fluency is reading that's rapid on map where the word form of the word appears immediately. The pronunciation, spelling, meaning of the word immediately accessed by the reader. And the system that seems to be critical in the skill of fluency is this system in the left side. It's in an area between the occipital lobe and the temporal lobe, left occipital temporal region or the word form region. And scientists working in Paris, State of Han, this research group, have really begun to show you some of those images. And then you've got to understand the organization of this area in the back of the brain still. Now, we know that this area, this region of the brain is for skilled and fluent reading from several lines of study. One of our own investigations, we show that this left occipital temporal word form area is a big mouthful, but that's what we're talking about, that area I showed in yellow, increases in activation of the skill of the reader. And here is various data from our own studies. So remember, when we're imaging the children, not just imaging them, but we're giving them reading tests. So we know a child's reading score, for example, standardized by the Clark-Johnson test, and we can relate the score on that reading test to the brain age. And so the better the child, the higher the child's score then on that reading test, the more areas of the brain are activated, but not everywhere. left side of the back. So that's one important clue that this area is important for still profundity. Another bit of evidence comes from a study that a colleague in Paris has done, showing that this region responds without conscious effort. Let me show you that study. Here he shows to adult good French readers words on the computer screen. They appear every half second or so. People look at the words, reading, and many areas of the brain were activated. But then, Dahan did something very clever. He showed the words for such brief periods of time, kept them on the screen for such brief periods of time, that the person looking at the computer screen couldn't identify the words. But the person was seeing them subliminally because this region on the left side of the back of the brain is activated, even though the person couldn't consciously identify the words. So that's another clue that this area is important for automatic reading. And Dahan has gone on to do studies showing that this region in the left side of the back of the brain is organized in a fashion that goes from the back to the front. Parts of the brain, parts of this region in the back, are very good at identifying areas of the brain, just differences. And as you get more and more toward the front of the brain, the neurons activate, are activated by different kinds of stimuli. So that the very most anterior areas, ones closest to the front of this word form area, are the ones that are activated by the actual letters in the word. And I flipped this image showing that from the back of the brain to the front of the brain, not the front of the whole brain, just the front of that little area shown in yellow, the is organized so that more the neurons in the front, most anterior parts of this region, are activated by the letters themselves, the letters of the words. And here's another study that's just published by the same research group showing that this area on the left side of the back of the brain becomes more activated when you go from simple fonts that are just, you know, kind of nonsense fonts, just individual shapes, to actual words. You can see this progression in the brain. And that shows that this region is more, I mean, it's not that the area is changing, but the neurons within this region are tuned to word, become tuned. More people read the word, the more this area becomes, these areas that are tuned, able to be tuned to the actual words themselves become active. You've seen this image before, as the neural signature slash, it shows this disruption of posterior systems. And so one obvious question that change the brain if you provide an effective information. And we asked that in a study we did several years ago. We examined a group of second and third graders who were involved in a study where we said, can an effective intervention change the brain? And we studied three groups of the second and third graders. A group of people, many controls who were good readers. And we studied two groups of impaired readers, a group who received experimental intervention, and a group who received whatever their local school system. Now the experimental intervention was the kinds of things that everybody has learned that are very helpful in teaching coding, that is, it has to be explicit. Focused on the fundamental principle. This involved individual tutoring every day in the entire school year. And not surprisingly, we studied the image of children before the intervention began. Right after the intervention, again the school year, then we waited until another school year when the image of children began. And it shouldn't surprise you that the children who received experimental intervention compared to the children who were poor readers who received whatever the school system was providing, improve their reading accuracy and fluency. That's a given. But what was so interesting was that the brain changed as well. And let me tell you how these images were created. These are two separate regions of the brain. The area is somewhat above the other. And we created these images by comparing the children's brain images before the intervention began to what they looked like 1 year after the intervention ended. And where you see yellow, those regions that have changed in this group of children who received experimental intervention. And that those areas that changed are the area of the right side of the front of the brain, left at five dimension, the general on this side. And so left side of the front of the brain, the two areas of the left side of the back of the brain. What this taught us is that teaching matters. We like to say that a good teacher can do what a neurosurgeon can't do, and that is change the brain, not the face. So teaching matters. And effective, dedicated, knowledgeable teachers. We've also learned something about two neural systems, two types of reading disability. And we've learned this from studying men and women who are participants in the Connecticut Longitudinal Study. Sally showed you this image before of Carlos. And I show it to you again to indicate that when we began the study, brain imaging wasn't available in the early 1980s. But it is available now, so the children. Better than for adults around 20 or so, we brought them back and brought back for imaging. And we brought back three groups of men and women. Because we've been seeing these men and women since they've been in kindergarten, we had reading scores every year throughout first grade through 12th grade. And we were able to go back to our data and recruit three groups. Group who never had evidence of a reading problem in any of the grades. Those are our non-impaired groups. A second group were men and women who, in third grade, were inaccurate readers. But by ninth grade, were no longer inaccurate. They could decode. They weren't fluent, but they could decode. We call that group accuracy improved readers. And for all intents and purposes, they compensated in some way. And the third group were a group of men and women who were inaccurate readers in third grade and even in ninth grade continue to be inaccurate readers. We call that persistent poor readers. And so we imaged the task that I've shown you before, the Munson-Worth task. That wasn't terribly helpful in understanding the differences. But this task was, and this was where we asked the men and women to read real words. And these are very simple real words. These are very simple real words. The task is, tell us whether these real words are in the same category, corn, rice, or food, lime, tree, are not in the same category. We show many of these samples, and in this task, reading simple real words, we saw very interesting differences between the two groups of poor readers and compared to the non-impaired readers. Now, let me walk you through this. This is the same level of imaging. Left is on what is your right by radiological intervention. But typical readers, activator region, you can see yellow, the left side, the front of the brain, there's two regions in the back. The compensated readers read activator region on the left side of the front of the brain, but have that disruption, that neural signature, the selection that I showed you. This region is visual. But these other regions are not active. That's what we come to expect about the neural signature for dyslexia. The persistently poor readers surprise us. They activated a region, reading these very simple real words, activated a region to the left side of the front of the brain, and both regions in the left side of the back of the brain. They're still learning poor readers. How could they? And they look like non-impaired readers. How could they be reading these? How could their neural systems look this way? Well, one of the things we knew was that they were, by other study, other tests we were doing, they were probably reading these very simple real words. You saw 23-year-old people reading these four-letter words, very simple. They're probably reading them by memory. And to explore this in more detail, we use a technique called connectivity analysis. And basically what we say is, we ask whether, what regions are connected. There's the skill reading area, word form area. We ask what regions are connected to the skill reading area. And the non-impaired readers, the region that's connected to this region on the left side of the front of the brain, one of the regions. And that's one of the regions that I told you is important in reading, part of the reading system. The persistent, poor readers can ask that same question. What region is connected to this area on the left and the skill reading area? Turns out it's this region on the right side of the front of the brain, and that's a region that scientists have long known are important in memory. So this is another clue that the way these persistent poor readers of reading is essentially using memory systems. And so what we just compare groups, the group who compensated compared to the group who not. In the group who compensated, they have those disrupted neural systems, that neural signature. Actually, you've developed those altered neural pathways that I've shown you a few minutes ago. Persistent poor readers, reading these simple real words, it looks like their posterior system is present, but they're just not used in the usual way. They're linked rather than out of the Boston reading system, they're linked to the Boston reading system. We also, because this is a longitudinal study of men and women since they've been in kindergarten, we could go back to the data and look at differences as early as kindergarten and first grade to see how these two groups differ. And what we learned was that as early as kindergarten and first grade, the group who compensated had a higher variability of attending less disadvantaged schools than the persistent disability. And what this suggested to us is that this group who compensated to some degree are men and women who have an inherent propensity for reading dyslexia, classic dyslexia, developmental dyslexia, while the group who are persistent poor readers, we believe to some degree have their reading problems because they have poor language at home and have not had as access to their best education as good education as this group. Now, we will emphasize that the same reading intervention for the focus of reading should be. Keep in mind this is important to the memory system because it's going to be important when I tell you about this last bit of information that we recently talked about. On trying to understand the development of reading systems in typical readers and dyslexic readers. We studied a fairly large group of boys and girls ranging from age 7 to 18 years. And what we found is, this image shows the development of reading systems. These are the systems that are related to the age of the child with other factors. And in the non-impaired readers, the system that develops during age is part of this word form system that I've shown you, and it's a part that's more interior to the ground. I color coded it in green. The system that is developing in the dyslexic reader is somewhat more in the middle of the brain, it's medial, it's a little more posterior, and that's color-coded that for the non-impaired reading dyslexic man. Slightly different systems. But what is interesting to us is that these systems have parallels to what we learned from Japanese investigators on the differences between two Japanese writing systems, a system called kana and a system called kanji. Kana seems to be more localized to this lateral region, which is what we see in our conscience seems to be vocalized in one of the older, much more parallel to the dyslexic. Now, the way kanji work, the Japanese children learn kanji first. It's essentially a syllabic system. It's a sound-based system. So the word sayonara is made up of these five Japanese characters. And this is the system that Japanese children learn, right as they begin in school. So it's a sound-based system. It's parallel to the way to our English system. Sound-based system. Kanji is very different. It's a memory-based system. The Japanese children learn this somewhat later in school, and they have to memorize the logographs. Here is a logograph of a Japanese character, a kanji character for man, and the Japanese textbooks say, "Look, this looks like a man." And this you can't see. This is for a woman. There's a picture, they show the picture of a woman holding her skirt and they try to make a parallel to this kanji character. But the important is that this is much more parallel to this kanji system has many parallels to the way dyslexic readers read, more of a memory-based system. And I've tried to summarize it here. We have non-character readers activating the system more anterior lateral in this word-form area, much more parallels to this sound-based Japanese system, whereas the dyslexic reader is activating the region that's more parallels to this memory-based Japanese writing system. I'm going to stop here. That's a lot of neuroscience to make you listen to. But we're excited about this, and we're excited because it, for the first time, it allows a hidden disability to become visible. Well, Sally and I are also aware of the fact that the science is interesting. Yes, but what is important is how do you translate the epidemiology, the cognitive science, the neuroscience that Sally and I both talked about in the last few minutes. How do we translate that? After today, Sally's going to come back and try to bring that together and how we translate the science into the search. Thank you.
And it helps because we've lived long enough that I've seen children in the world into adulthood. And we really, our interest is what can be done to make children who are dyslexic and adults who are dyslexic. What can be done to have those individuals have a better life. So let's see what we can do. One of the major implications is that we have the potential to be in a new period of education. And as we are here in your wonderful state, in your wonderful city of Madison, we hear about the reality of some wonderful things that are happening, but we also hear about some things that should be happening that don't seem to be. So I can't say this is true everywhere in the country, unfortunately. I can't say we are in a new era. Perhaps at Woolridge, perhaps at Fort Atkinson, perhaps at the Madison Learning and Reading Center, and other places, but in many places, and that's a shame. We can be also a linear in access. We'll talk about that too, but that's still a potential and not a reality. And what we have is a new hope through science for the future that can really transform lives. So how does science inform identification? Well, what we now know is because we understand the basic difficulties on cognitive and confirmed by a neurobiologic evidence, we know what we can look for that might give us clues. Even in a preschool child, we can look for clues. And that's why I focus so much on scope doing, because we can look for schools in a preschool child, a child who has delayed speech, a child who has a family history of reading problems, a child who perhaps two or three doesn't appreciate lines, doesn't think that she can read because Dr. Seuss, who look those words rhyme and play with sounds and words. As they get older, as you get older, you might do better, as you can generate better sounds, and sounds and out words. So we can have clues to really look at on children who risk. And those children can so benefit by having evaluation by a speech and language pathologist who really understands spoken language. And I'm so pleased to see my colleagues in pediatrics here today, because pediatricians are the ones who have the potential in the space of children from birth and family, and they follow it. And what we have to do is try to evolve the educational and medical community in partnership. The brain is involved in the reading, and we really have to make sure that those two wonderful groups have bridged and communicate. Another really important group is the child who is terrified of reading out loud. This is the child when they know they're being told on to read aloud in class, suddenly has to go to the bathroom, or is the class loud, or will figure out a weird position to be told on, and will perfectly also go around and practice reading in a sentence. So this fear of reading aloud is very, very profound. And what should that be? Because if you send a child walking violently like him or herself, you have no idea what they're reading. If they're reading, if they're mispronouncing, skipping lines, you don't know. But when you have to read aloud, you're naked. Everybody can see really what's going on. And what's been so profoundly impressive to me is we've spoken to people, adults who are dyslexic, and are one of the most successful individuals, not only the dyslexics, but in the world. They've been very successful. And you say to someone, well, what was school like before you? And what do you see in the baseballs? And so much as the tears, and they say, I remember the terror of being called on to your lab, and you get a sticker. And the other kids would know the shame, lifelong shame that's been associated with it. So when you see a child, that boy who is fearful of reading aloud, you know, you even know in adults, in one of our studies involving adults, readers with dyslexia, a couple of angels, he is dyslexic, she's not, and he told us about the Bible study class. He read as being called on to read aloud, and sometimes his wife would read for him, and people say, oh, no, that's Jimmy. And those of you who, like ourselves, celebrate Passover, part of that is one of the nouns of sacredity, reading aloud from above. And he very reinvited his relative or friend who realized, oh, God, I'm going to do it. We've had that experience personally, and I know so many people who actually speak come up and tell me their shared experience with this. So anytime someone has to do and they're dyslexic, it's a painful experience. Another is reading the slow reading. This is a really good and important clue. So many times, an individual will tell me about themselves, or a parent will tell me, oh, he's not dyslexic. He just reads slowly. Well, you just heard that left occipital temporal vertebral area is a working machine. Why do you think an intelligent, motivated person would read slowly? They read slowly because they have an inefficient vertebral area and they're dyslexic. So that's a really important sign. Slow reading, to many, I'm included, it's a sine qua non being dyslexic with caregivers, children, young adults, and adults. And why do we worry about it? We worry about it because very often, as I've said earlier, and I passionately believe, dyslexic children and adults think in different ways and very bright. So often you can see a dyslexic student being part of a peer study group, and they often are the ones who explain the concept to their peers, and they study together. But then you take the test, and what happens? Mother says, "Oh, how did you do it?" And the child hands his head, and the parent says, "I failed." "But how did you fail to do it so well?" The answer, "I couldn't finish the test." Or, because they know they read slowly, they race through it, and so they careless errors. And what we're seeing now, obviously, much more about this in a few minutes, is how so many young people are being penalized because they're not being allowed extra time on high-stakes, standardized examinations. Another important code is the child who says reading is boring. When do you think reading is boring? If your workroom area is operating at maximum efficiency, if it is, reading is pleasurable. It's automatic, you don't have to think about it. It's reading is pleasurable. But if you're dyslexic, I'll say more about this in a few minutes, you have to work so hard at reading. Then it becomes a job, a painful job, and then it becomes boring or whatever word you want. But those are the four clues. To read aloud, reading slowly, avoiding reading or saying reading is boring, and also a daily history of reading problems. So, in our clues, affecting both identification and management, we move from clues in spoken language. Everybody can do that. We look at reading as in slow, choppy, particularly familiar words. Does the child or adult like a strategy? Do they need to have cards of foreign language? If reading is difficult, spelling is really difficult. In reading, you decoding letters into the sounds. Spelling with an encode. We start with the sounds and we encode it into letters. And very often, even as children are remediated, spelling becomes the last telltale sign. Poor handwriting. We think that the difficulty is forming letters may be the motor analog of the difficulty with sounds and articulating sounds. But dyslexic children and adults tend to have great difficulties with handwriting. And what's so fortunate now is that we have word processing. And I think far too many teachers and parents bring too long to teach the children word processing. So that can be done fairly early on in elementary school, primary school, it should be done. Pay attention. I'll go into this more in a moment. When someone is a fluent reader, why is that? It's important because it means that a well-equipped reader is automatic. What is that? That means you don't have to use your intentional resources. You know the word, and you know it. You know how you don't tell your moms to go to the mouth, they just do it. When you're automatic, you look at the word, and you know it. If you're not, remember what we said at the very beginning? It's not that you can't read, but you have to look so hard. Because it's not automatic, it's still ethical. So you have to gather all of your intentional resources to focus and work so hard on that work. So very often, children and adults who are dyslexic look like they're not paying attention because it takes so much of their intentional capacity to do the reading. And that tells us that it's also tiring. One of our studies I remember with adults, we would call people the next day and told one of them, they said, because you know, we study reading, so we only ask people to do all sorts of tasks related to reading, they take up time and effort afterwards. Because I wish we had a little bit of a meter to measure effort, because when you're dyslexic and you're reading, you're using a lot. So it's very tiring. So it's very important to remember that. What does it mean in a practical way? What it means is that children and adults who are dyslexic should try to have a reading quiet, non-disruptive, distracted environments. It means that
that they should get improved grades, because they really feel tired. I know I was a school principal tutor yesterday, and I'm kind of ways of making sure the children that she works with take those grades. And to really remember, even though you don't see it, how hard these individuals are working. Our message, if you have difficulty learning the primary phonology, is your primary language, what is it like to have to learn second language? It's standard. And in fact, very difficult. We at Yale are very proud to have been the students for this. In fact, now I have a policy for the last 12, 10, 15 years where we bring the structure of Yale to the foreign language department to our students with dyslexia. And it's really interesting because when we first began, I had to go, as I say, across campus and meet with the foreign language department. I was terrified. Here I was going, and I was going to tell a required faculty of the required course that their course was not required. I think I was going to be very popular, probably wasn't. But they listened, and they granted it. And now, 15 years later, they will call me and say, Dr. Shavis, I have this student who's working so hard. They come, I met with them individually, they've had tutoring, and they will just not master a foreign language at the level required at Yale. Low grades, you memorize equal things, not much is expected. But the goal of the foreign language is to become converted, certainly college level, to be conversant with the foreign culture, to be able to read and speak the right language. And they, the professors themselves, have been feeling that these students who are brilliant, successful in every way they want to be able to do this. So we now grant a portion of this, they take a course in culture of the country. And you know what? Yale is not falling in the end. I say that because it seems in so many educational settings, particularly in independent schools, it's like, the mark of an educated person is to be able to speak the foreign language. Well, that's true of education. But to torment people and have them waste their time on what they can do well, when they could do so many other things well, is just a denial of what we scientifically. So this is a plea for you to take back to your surroundings that if a student is dyslexic, not to turn them then, and think of how slowly students with dyslexia read, when it comes to have accurate, to have no coordination, or to be able to do their work, rather than sitting and feeling utterly stupid. And we, which is surprising, many times we go and visit a child we know, classroom, and we see children who we know are dyslexic sitting in our language class. Doing this, they're doing that, they're not looking like that. And why do we worry about this? Because we worry because no matter who you are, what your circumstances are, no child in school will say, I'm not going to read. Every child in school, when the parents say, oh, you can learn how to read, and children look forward to it. And you think, what happens to these children when they can't read? Actually, not too long ago, I was with someone who was from this area, and she was telling me that she had a big family history of dyslexia, Chet Branson, who was preschool. She said she learned about what happens at that moment when a child who is dyslexic is in the classroom and suddenly realizes that all his friends and classmates can do easily with who she supposed to. How does it make them feel? And we have a sense because what we see is the groundness of self-esteem all the time, the development of incredible anxiety and depression, which is so necessary. And that's why it's so important that we're having this conference and that all of you are here today, because there are a lot of problems, but change has to start somewhere. And people like yourselves and ourselves have to do something
how the problem is managed.
We have to make sure that things are in the
what are the things in young adults? Well, the same might happen to children that are older. We see sexual speech difficulty in spoken language. We see this for pronunciation. Sometimes they differ, sometimes they're very embarrassing. We see the struggle between two words. Often it's on the tip of the tongue, and that becomes important for the very old students who struggle their whole lives, and they go to college. And then they want to go to medical school, law school, graduate school, and they can do it. But for example, in medicine, we have this terrible thing on the ground, it's called PIPIC. You ask the medical student questions. And part of the myth has become, it's not what they answer to help with. Some kind of vastness is related to knowledge, which is total nonsense. So students feel terrible and looked upon, or when they're in law school, called them PIPIC. And the total fallacy that sometimes quickness is related to depth and breadth and knowledge. So what happens is that dyslexic students, children or adults, then you hear the kind of constrictive vocabularies. They don't want to try every word. They may know what it means, but they're so worried about mispronouncing it. So they stick with what they think and say, well. And as they get older, we see this lack of fluency, the fatigue of reading slowly and the avoidance of reading. And it's really amazing because we've had so many adults who are very accomplished, but they say, well, you know how many books I've read? Not very many. I only read what I have to. Spelling remains disastrous. And what is really sad is seeing in our college students a sacrifice of social life. So that they can study more thoroughly. We talk about dedication. We talk about 24/7 O's. You're dyslexic, and they're the originals. They were so hard. We had a student, Dale, who's very dyslexic and brilliant. And I happened to be with the parents not too long ago, and they were sharing how hard it was for him. And was like, well, oh, come on, don't you want to go to movies? Don't you want to do this? And particularly now, she sometimes hear her voice say, I know you're there studying, why don't you come out and join us? She would have loved nothing better. But she knew that if she did work 10 times as hard as everyone else, she wouldn't be able to be successful. She did work 10 times as hard. And she has been very successful over very, very, very education. And again, we have to put in mind the stress and what goes to it. They are really important. So the slow reader can be the best. Okay, here we are. Teaching reading. What do we know about teaching reading? How do we most effectively teach ourselves? The first question is, what do we teach? How do we teach? Well, for the first time, we have an answer. We look to the evidence. As you know, that fellowship is an higher position. So if a parent comes to see us and says, that expects us to pick the most effective treatment. And how will we know what we get? Well, we'll think of a peer-reviewed scientific article that's compared to treatment A and treatment B, and select the one that works best. That's what makes sense. And that's called evidence-based medicine. And we should really expect that kind of practice from the physicians that you see. Well, the amazing thing is, that's never been done in education. Really, the last of our second-class citizens are children. We talk, particularly during the political season, about children are most important. That's not how we have to devote so much to children. But when it comes time to do the most important thing we can in school, teach them by methods and approaches that are known to be effective, that doesn't seem to happen. And it can't happen that I see so many times parent is told the last day of school, well, I hope he has a better year each year. You know, it's not like being on an ECR that you can take an 8-year-old's life, try something that doesn't work. Okay, new mind, put it on the board, let's go again. Children are only 7 or 8 once in a lifetime, and we have that opportunity. And we have to get ready. We don't have everything. There's so much we don't know, but we have to use what we do know, and there's quite a bit of that. So we have to look at the evidence. Much of the evidence was put together in the report of the National Media Panel. In 1998, Congress became very concerned with what seems to be an epidemic of media problems in this country. So Congress mandated that the National Media Panel be appointed, and I was honored to serve on the National Media Panel. And our mandate, our mission, was to review the existing knowledge of reading, studies, and reading, and determine which methods and which approaches were most effective. And in April of 2000, we presented our report to Congress. This report is available, and we've summarized it in our book as well. And what do we do? We bond to read children must be taught five essential elements of reading. One is reading awareness skills. That's what we were talking about early on. And it involves spoken language. For children to be able to notice and identify and manipulate the individual sounds, the basic optimal sounds, components in spoken language. It's not enough only to learn the sounds, they have to learn how the letters and sounds are linked. That's called phonics. And it's best if that instruction is systematic and explicit. We want children not only to be able to be active, but to be able to read fluently, rapidly, and understanding. We want them to know what the words mean, to develop the vocabularies, and to also comprehend connected text. So five critical elements in teaching include awareness, phonics, literacy, vocabulary, and comprehension. Phonics. It's amazing how teaching media can be so controversial. Why phonics? Do I wish we had more lingual sound to it? Yes. We have to take an ignore the name. What it is, it's the only strategy that allows a child to control new or unknown words. And why is that important? Because after third grade, a child comes across so many words you hear, maybe 10,000 words. And they're long, they're complicated, and some words only show up in a handful of time. The message is, children don't have the memory capacity to memorize all that, those words. They have to have a strategy that allows them to face new or unfamiliar words and figure it out. And that's why phonics is helpful. It provides that strategy. But at the same time, phonics is not the whole story. What we need to do is look at the bigger picture. And it was so wonderful to be with the folks from Walbridge and the Madison Media Learning Center, because they were extra teachers and they had a whole array of toolbox, they had a toolbox. And they knew which of these elements to teach, at which phase to introduce new ones. For example, if we think of the arch of reading, on one leg it's accuracy, on the other leg it's comprehension. The keystone joining those is fluency. And it's very recognized fluency is beginning to get the attention that it deserves. What is fluency? By definition, the ability to read accurately and rapidly and with good intonation upon comprehension. And as I said earlier, it's important because attention is such a limited resource, and if you're not reading fluently, you have to get to the attention. You have to work, it becomes effortful. And I'll give you just one example. We spoke not too long ago before we were physicians, and one of those physicians, a pediatrician, came up to speak to me after this. And she said, you know, Dr. Chavis, I'm a pediatrician, and I'm dyslexic. She said, I'm also a fraternal twin,
would be younger.
My twin sister, who was not dyslexic, she would sit down and I'd watch her turn those pages one after another. She said, you know, you can drop a bomb next to her. She wouldn't know that she knew her screen. She said, maybe I would sit down and if somebody dropped a book on the letter, I would listen to that. And there would be my 3 days. So, aha, she should really capture the differences. And one thing that's important is when you don't have to work with something, it's pleasurable. So if you're not doing a new movie, which you only know sticks with you really have, you don't need pleasure or work. So what do we know about becoming a movie? We know that first you have to learn to pay attention to the individual sounds and spoken words, and then you have to know how these sounds letters, and you analyze it with sound and not sound, but that's slow, effortful, and non-automatic. But what's new, and what's so exciting, is we learned, as you heard Dr. Bennett share, is what has to happen in the brain. And what has to happen in the brain is you have to build a neural model in the brain. And what happens is children read a word over and over again. Just reading the word over and over, and reading it over and over accurately. Those connections come together, and after a while, after a child's ready, we don't know how many times, half dozen or so, we don't know. But those connections come together. Initially, correct is a child may mispronounce a word, but as they pronounce the word out loud, accurately, over and over again, the connections reflect all the important information about the word, what it means, how you pronounce it, and how you spell it, come together. And then they store the word together. And then the child only has to see the word and recognizes it. How having to work at it. And that's our goal. You have an instant word recognition, but what that means, you have an exact model. Really important is fluency occurs very early by the end of the first grade, the beginning of junior fluency. So you imagine what happens when children are not identified so much later. How many words and peers will they be able to learn? And equally important is it's not staged. You don't know when developing children learn to stand up, walk, and then run. They're staged. Changing the fluency, the evidence seems to suggest, is word by word or large word by word by word. So that means changing it. That means that children get behind very quickly. If anyone can, you know, please raise your hand. Work hard to speak a little loud. And this figure is in my book, but it represents the work of a researcher named Anderson. And he did something very interesting. He asked the grade students to keep a log of how much they read after school. So here you can see the test scores on the coordinate and y-axis. On the x-axis is the time spent reading each day. And you can't, it's hard to see here, but the best readers, see they score 50%. They read about 20 minutes a day. And they read 1.8 million words. Kids in the middle read much less, 4.8 minutes, and they read about 280,000 words a year. The book says the poorest readers, very poorest down here, they read less than a minute, which means they read hardly read at all. And they read 8,000 words a year. So you might say, well, 8,000 words, that's a lot. But you can have some perspective when you appreciate that what it took these struggling readers, if you're to read, and how long it would take these guys? Minutes. So you can imagine over time how this builds up. And by the third grade, it could be thousands and thousands and thousands of words. So what are the implications? One, we have to identify children earlier and after they have some things to see folks here from school systems. honest, and my apologies, I don't remember the sisters, but you're really doing a great deal early identification. You've been in the preschool level, you look at risk factors, and because it's oral language, you look at their abilities in the language processing. We have to measure fluency. We have to make sure you measure speed and not only the accuracy of reading. If you give, for example, a test that you looked at Johnson, where it's back to your identification, you can make an error and then make another error that you get by eventually to get correct. So that doesn't tell you how the child can struggle or if they're fluent. And there are measures now of child rate or digital rate or the cost that can give you some index. Fluency, of course, the goal is as well. And the key thing is to facilitate by practice. That becomes really important. The practice of generally oral reading with feedback and guidance, repeated reading with feedback and guidance. And it takes a while. It's always so impressive to me is that if John's on a football or a hockey team, we don't think much of their practicing for civil rights after school or cheerleading or what. But you say, well, we need to practice more. Well, there's no time for that. How can we do that? But we have to do that. We can't do the brain, whether it's cheerleading, whether it's playing violin, or whether it's reading, the brain learns to practice. We need to practice. And this is key. Difficulty is fluency or lifetime. Accuracy may improve, but fluency does not. So we have to get children growing and ensure that they become fluent readers. For the National Reading Gallery, we compare two different approaches to teaching fluency. One is, as I mentioned, repeated oral reading with feedback and guidance. The other is encouraged by silent reading. A lot of animals, children out there, children who use silent reading, which may have been struggling with their carpet or one of the new ways you use yourself. Well, the data is very strong in indicating that repeated oral reading with feedback and guidance is effective. We cannot find a body of evidence to indicate that if you're struggling to hear, you can go over the corner and read silently. You're going to be a better reader. You have no idea what children are reading or putting out the window. So you have to make sure that children are reading out loud, repeatedly, and what happens is the teacher or peer tutor will read a passage of interest, I think it's hopefully an easy passage. Then the student will read it and the teacher will gently. That's why I worry sometimes the parents doing this because you get so frustrated. Don't you know that? So it's probably better than somebody else do that. And it's scaffolded back and forth. And eventually after the child has read the word correctly over and over again, that child will become fluent in that word. And then in more words. And that becomes critical.
Classified as working class, just about half of them are still learning to hear, and You also want to ensure that children not only hear the word accurately, fluently, and have the word of their vocabulary, but the real goal of the ACT is to get to meaning. So it's important to realize how interrelated vocabulary and reading comprehension are, that learning to listen then is related to learning to read. Initially, children learn through listening. Children begin school, they take in their information. Listen, as they go through school, print, reading becomes more and more important. However, as they go through school, this gap narrows. So by grade 7, children learn more from reading. And that's what we say children now are mature learning. Children become young adults, virtually all their reading, all their reading, and all of their learning takes place in puberty. So what do we know about effective reading instruction? You know, I feel like I'm batting over the head. It's really important early intervention. It's key. We have to identify children earlier and more accurately. We have to use evidence-based methods. We can't have people say, in my heart, you know, it works. Or, I agree with the philosophy. Who wouldn't accept that from a physician? You know, when you have a heart attack and the scientific evidence says, this works, but your physician says, well, I'm not going to use that. It's in my heart. I know that. We know it was utter nonsense. And why do we let our children be taught by belief systems rather than by rigorous scientific evidence? This is 2007. That's just not acceptable. And each one of you, if you're part of the school system, and depending on who chooses the reading group, you have to ask, what is the evidence? If you're a parent, you're going to ask that demand that your child be taught by methods approaches that have been validated through scientific evidence. Nothing less is acceptable, because we all know, and I've seen it, and you've seen it, the pain and the loss of potential that occurs when belief systems take over and students are victims. And knowledgeable teachers. We have to make sure that teachers, every teacher, you don't go into teaching rather than running a hedge fund because you want to make $1 million. You go into teaching because you care about children and you want your students to learn to read. And so we have to make sure that we provide teachers with the knowledge and the tools that will allow them to do the job they want to do. Intense instruction. If you're structuring your university in a lower class of 20 or 25, you're going to be it's unfair to you, it's unfair to your teacher. Children need it, what do we need to a small group. And you know what? The smaller, the better. Individual is the best. You know, for financial reasons, sometimes this doesn't happen, but we should fool ourselves and say, oh, it's for the child, it's for interest. Or the cops and story why it's better to be in this group or that group. The evidence increasingly is pointing to the importance of small and optimally individual instruction for children. And sufficient duration. When you have a child struggling to read, you can't give them a day of intervention. Oh, 20 minutes a day, 3 times a week. That's just not going to do it. You need to devote 60, 90 minutes every day of the week to teaching children who are struggling to read better. It's just incomprehensible how we're devoted to children in society and we penalize them early on by having not had the tools to learn to read. And all of these, the range mentioned, the evidence-based methods, the knowledge of the teachers, the intense instruction, the sufficient duration. It's not to pick one. You have to pick all of them. And there's no reason we can't except rejection and motivation. And we have to be exposed to the problem. that we can do better, and that it's moral, civil, and whatever other obligation we can say, to do that. What's important to keep in mind is that evidence is continually building, and to be considered really strong evidence, there should be what we call convergent evidence. It shouldn't only be one study, it should be several studies that all converge to find the same results. Again, the most success is at the younger students. The data for interventions, page 2, for example, are really excellent. It comes down to that, not in every case. But you will then sort of stack the head in favor of the child. Do that in order to get earlier. This is so important. We so often, you know, we're talking about programs. We want to use evidence-based programs. But we're all talking is the teacher, the one who delivers the programs. And the evidence indicates more and more that teachers often have more power in the effectiveness of the intervention than the intervention itself. Ideally, what we want is evidence-based interventions delivered by knowledgeable, compassionate teachers. I cannot emphasize how important it is. I have seen what teachers can do, and you can do, as we said, more than your interpretive anything. And every child deserves not to have an evidence-based program, but a knowledgeable, compassionate teacher. And this is important too. People are forever writing to me on which programs. You know what? There's not a magic program out there. There's not one program that's head, shoulders, and all the others. What really impressed me, and I'm sorry to keep coming back to it, but I was just had a person speaking to the folks yesterday evening, is that they had this toolbox and they understood, well, this child may be better for this program. This child is the other program. It's not a one-size-fits-all. You put this program on the child, they will learn to read. You need knowledgeable teachers who have this toolbox at their disposal, and they know which program for which child. Clearly, it would be wonderful, hopefully, in the not-too-distant future between behavioral and neurobiologic studies, we'll be able to see which program is best for which child. But we don't have that. To tell us that. And that's really the knowledge of caring and devoted teachers. And this is really important as well. The improvement in phonologically based skills has always generalized fluency and comprehension improvements. You know, pendulum swing this way and that way. And we were once in the era of full language. Maybe in many places there are. And it was really important to pick up the scientific evidence that you need for knowledge and awareness and the products presented systematically and explicitly. But sometimes what happens is when the pendulum swings, it really goes to extreme. And what we want to emphasize is we now see children who have received the evidence, but they have received the fluency, the vocabulary, and the comprehension. So what we really need to do is have the whole thing in mind. It's not either or, but it's doing each of the scientifically validated. Okay. You know what we've learned? That children grow up. They become adults. And I don't think there's a parent that I would have to tell you that it's right or I've seen. Having said, who is a decisive child, what's going to become a child? And so it becomes really important for us now as we come to the final segment of our presentation to talk about adults who have a child with a history of dyslexia. What we know is the phonologic difficulty persists. It really does. We know that reading accuracy can improve to a great extent. But we don't often see the improvements. That remains with the young adults and the adults. So reading remains slow and worries. And so the problem is that we often, as a society, look for more clues to success
your judge, the gatekeeper to your future, is often how well you deal with standardized tests. You know, all these applicants, SAT, MCAT, U.S. Medical Aid, which is the U.S. Medical License Exam, LSAT, Law School, GRE. That becomes a barrier. That becomes the gatekeeper. And this is part of dyslexia. Young adults with anything like the potential, because these students who are climbing the mountain, and they're hanging on now at the very top, and they can get over it, but they're stopped in their track by people who speak nonsense. They have no idea the evidence or what the scientific literature says about the necessity for accommodations to dyslexic students. To give you an example, the writer, he received a 475 on his verbal SAT. So, of course, that means that he wasn't going to become a great writer because he's so productive. I'll give you a few other examples. The belief that to write well requires fast reading is spelling. That's fallacy. John Irving is even counting John Grisham. Our all wonderful writers and a little dyslexic. One of my favorite people is a man named Garrett Cook. Garrett is a science reporter from the Boston Globe, kind of an ethics paper, and he writes long articles about scientific issues. And he called me after my book Overcoming Dyslexia was published, and he said, Dr. Shaver, I'd like to speak to you about myself. And I said, what about? Probably you'll see why I can speak publicly about it in just a few minutes. He said, I'm dyslexic. I'm very hesitant to become public about it. There are people who lose me, have all these stereotypes, and people who are dyslexic, and sometimes I make spelling errors. I just don't know what to do. So we spoke. Then he called me back. I'm okay. He said, well, I decided to come out of the closet. And 2 weeks later, there was an article in the Boston Globe Sunday magazine by Garrett about his dyslexia. Well, you think, well, that's pretty good, but it gets bad. I think about a year or two ago, the Pulitzer Prize has been reported for announced. Yes, we're the only person of all these distinguished reporters of the Boston Globe to be awarded the Pulitzer Prize, Garrett Cook. And you know what he was awarded in it? Explanatory writing. And I think that gets to it. Because when you're dyslexic, you may do a score, but you can memorize a regurgitated. You really have to get to the meaning. You really have to understand it. It takes longer, but you have to be able to put your arms around it. So people who are dyslexic, I don't think it's so surprising that they're reading storytellers, because they get it. They get the narrative. And they're great reporters. A couple of years later, another reporter from the Washington Post, the Independent, came to see us with a similar story. We go over to Florida for this Washington Post Sunday magazine. And I share these stories because the myth is, well, if you're dyslexic, you will benefit. Not the way everybody else knows. So it's important to know what the potential is so that it's realized. Well, part of the question is to go well with living, but who's the father of modern surgery? He was a phenomenal neurosurgeon, and some of his inventions are still the tools used by a lot of neurosurgeons. And he was a graduate of Harvard, Yale, we've had his wonder. And I've gone there and went through some of the diaries and other materials, and it talks about how he put a terrible speller. Terrible, he was an English department, and having his mother, would sit with him and literally accompany him to school, going over his work because he was so dyslexic. That's a wonderful story. His granddaughter has become a very good friend of mine, a very distinguished lady from Manhattan. And she told him not too long ago, she went to see her in Circus Command, who she respects very much. And she mentioned to him that Harvey Cushing, who everyone in medicine knows who he is, because we have Cushing syndrome, Cushing is a great in medicine, and he won a Pulitzer Prize for it.
And she mentioned in that Barbie Christian was her grandfather, who was dyslexic, and that kind of thing. And she said, well, oh, a dyslexic person can do what he's done. So you see here, supposedly, the knowledgeable people, that kind of stereotype, bias, continues to exist to this day. Toby Cosgrove, I'll tell you more about him in a few minutes, is one of my favorite people. So the fallacy is that good writing requires imagination, creativity. It does, but dyslexic habit. And people, when you can't spell right, they suddenly assume that you can't write. And in my book, I write about gender, I write about Stephen Carroll, and Wendy Williams, for those of you who know, who unfortunately passed away, who was one who just was a brilliant playwright. And people have got to know that that people with dyslexic have this capability. Example, fast reading. John Irving avoids book talks. He says, you know, about the book talk, you need to have notes. And you can't read it fast. There are many attorneys, they were boards of great economies, probably one of the best contenders in the country. He's very dyslexic. John Irving told me that whenever he goes to an airport, he and his wife have this thing. He says, he doesn't tell her, but he always wants to be able to read on the airport monitor what gate they're going to. And he says, as soon as I get to the airport, I look at it. And his wife says, oh, John, this was a gate everywhere. And he says, I can never be there, even though I'm making it a contest. Because he ends up being a slow reader. Does anybody have a copy of the book that I can borrow? I just want to read to you. What John Irving said about his own reading. I read slowly. Where have you heard about that? And I read a lot. I read a paragraph if I'm not 100% concentrating on what I'm reading. Where if I'm the slightest bit tired, I have a problem. And from that to what I've learned that you have to concentrate twice as hard as somebody else who's not really automatically. You get twice as tired and twice as soon. So when I'm a little bit tired, the difference is enormous. I also have practice. I'm actually a very good reader of my own work, but I think it comes from my practice of reading my work out loud and understanding the cadence with which it's written. I read my own work aloud as I write it, or say it aloud as I write it. In fact, when I'm writing in my office at home, people often think that I'm on the phone. And guess what? He says, I use my finger as I did when I was a student, especially when I'm tired or when the print is a little too small. I just keep my finger blank. And when I do public readings, especially, I never take. So here's John Irving, who writes 500-600 page novels, who's a struggling reader. Imagine that. And Wendy Monsters came, I don't know if any of you here are familiar with her, but she had every playwriting award given. And she's also dyslexic. And why did she pick playwriting? I figured out they're short. They're also printed large. And there's a lot of white space on the page. So, let's just continue. So we have to remember that even those who read slowly have this magnificent sea of strength. This friend says that I try to indicate on a higher level of cognitive processes. So the person who reads slowly is also the person who has excellent thinking, conceptualization, and reasoning skills. And as I indicated with Gareth Cook, people who are dyslexic learn through me rather than through conversation. I'll show you a anecdote. I see everyone at Yale University who might be dyslexic, and quite a number of people, including students, are. And one was a young man who was a medical student. I spoke to him one day, and his wife, who's not dyslexic, and she told me, she said, you know, when we prepare for a test, she said, I study take the test, I finish quickly, and I get very good grades. My husband, which is such an agony for him to prepare, he reads slowly, he doesn't get as good grades as I do, and guess what? 2 weeks later, he'll have to remember it, and I won't. I memorized it, and he went to the room, so I think that's really important. And people who are dyslexic seem to think in a different way, an Adam Ross way. They're able to get the big picture, to simplify. And their listening comprehension is often very high. So you can't judge just by word and identification scores. So, in young adults who have learning disabilities, who want to work toward going to college, graduate, or professional schools, the issue is access. What do I mean by that? Accommodations primarily, but not only, extra time. And several years ago, Dr. Benachides and I were invited to speak at the American Association of Medical Colleges. And let me share with you what we shared with the physicians at that meeting. And that is, a student's request for accommodations represents only a small piece of a very large effort put forth by the student him or herself. Accommodations, this is key, by themselves do not produce success. You're not getting some of the answer. Accommodations only act as a catalyst that allows success to happen, that allows all the effort that has been put forth and all the higher order cognitive abilities to show them. So simply put, dyslexia robs a person of time, accommodations, material. And what Bennett and I have been most rapid about is being able to demonstrate neurobiological evidence for the necessity of extra time. So here you see this cutaway that I showed you earlier, the non-linear theater. You have the area to the left side of the brain, the area in the front, and the two areas in the back. In a dyslexic reader, you have compensation right, left, and front, and on the right. But this area that's so critical, the word form area, doesn't perform the word efficiently. And you have to rely on these ancillary systems. And what they can do is you can be effective, but not fluently. And I like to think of it as if you are a typical reader and have that vertical system operating at maximum efficiency. Reading is like getting on the express highway. You just get on it and you whiz by, it's a pleasure to read. If you're dyslexic, it's as if there's a blockage in that express highway. You have to get on it. Take the secondary, ancillary. I would think of it as a country road. It's bumpier, it's more circuitous. It'll get you there, but you have to work harder. So that, to me, is a very hopeful way of thinking about what happens in dyslexic students. You get partial compensation for accuracy, but not for authenticity. And very often, students who are not automatic, it's even effortful with the extra time. And they also end up having the anxiety added to it, which almost all the areas have. So I try to, in the cartoon, show you what might happen. So going from text to meaning, most students just automatically miss through coding and meaning. If you're dyslexic, there's a glitch here and you can't do that. So what you have to do instead is go around, and if you have extra time, you can use your intelligence, your vocabulary, or your conceptual skills to figure out what the word is. But you can only do that if you have the time that you need to do it. So in access for accommodations, there's a critical need for dyslexic children and adults. Standardized testing agencies seem to be a law on themselves, which they shouldn't be in terms of the ADA. And they often ignore the scientific evidence and deny access. And as a result, an increasing number, I'm sorry to say, deserving students are prevented from reaching their potential and realizing their dreams. So what about the long-term outcome of dyslexic individuals? Often they're among our highest level conceptualizers who think in a different way, as I said earlier, are capable of out-of-the-box thinking. And what happens if they can get through all of these barriers or these gatekeepers and they can focus on an area that they're interested in, you know what happens?
change can become automatic. And several years ago, not too long ago, actually, the two of us were invited to speak at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco with Charles Schwab, who, as many of you may know, dyslexic. And somebody asked Mr. Schwab about his reading. He said, well, every year when we go on meditation, I take Shogun with me. And I believe he said, I'm still on chapter 1, chapter 10. On the other hand, he said, you give me the Wall Street Journal, I read that. That's what he knows, and he gives it over and over again. And people who are dyslexic, as we have got the idea, are capable of high accomplishment. They're often the leaders of science, medicine, law, business, writing, literature, and poetry. And we'll be finished in just a few minutes. When I was writing my book, as I told many people, it's a labor of love, a long labor, 5 years. And I thought I was finished. And then I got penetrated, and I was invited to a college in Amherst, Massachusetts. And we met with some of the faculty, and they said, Dr. Shaler, do you understand that you're interested in dyslexia? And I said, yes. And they said, well, what do you think about those people? They didn't know anything. I said, well, what do you mean by that? And they said, what do you mean these people who are dyslexic? They want to be doctors and lawyers and educators to imagine a person like that. And then I knew that I had to add another section to my book. It's the epilogue. You know what I called it? A Person Like That. And in it, I wanted to write about all those folks who struggle to read slowly, but accomplish great things. Because I wanted to make sure that parents, particularly teachers, in the lower grades, when they see that struggling child, they wouldn't only think of that child going into trades or whatever, but that child would also be capable of great accomplishments. So I wrote about a number of these people, writers that I read, Stephen J. Campbell, who's a wonderful movie. For any of you who watch on television, The A-Team, or The Rock Group Files, or Coretta, or know about Mr. T, he's responsible for that. And he writes one or two mysteries books every year. But they told him in school that he had no future writing. He was John Irving, and he wanted to do Richard and so forth. I think we have particularly a large number of individuals who are dyslexic who are entrepreneurs because their creative thinking really puts them on the path that others might not have thought of. So you might not know the name Paul Orpah, but I think 30 kilos. And that's when Paul started. Charles Schwab, Sir Richard Branson, a Virgin Airlines. I think he's done a few things that have been successful. Again, Ingvar Kamprad might not be familiar with you. I don't know if you have ideas in Wisconsin. Well, that was his idea. I think he's one of the boldest people in the world now. Bill Hewlett, Craig Paul, John Chambers, these are all characters in social science, in the business and financial world. And what's been so interesting to me is that there are so many dyslexic physicians and scientists. Harvey Cushing, Toby Hunter, I'll talk about in a moment. Helen Tassler is really the mother, I guess you'd say, of pediatric cardiology. A few years ago, somebody wrote me a note, and they had been in Helen Tassler's medical school class and said, Helen didn't like to read, she was dyslexic, so she preferred to look at cardiograms and textbooks. So she became very interested in cardiology. A number of Nobel laureates, Baruch Benacerraf, Niels Bohr, and I truly believe Albert Einstein was dyslexic. I'm an alumnus of Albert Einstein College of Medicine, and I was president of the alumni organization. I had to give a talk on Einstein once, and I read it, and I said, oh my God, this man is truly clearly dyslexic. So one of the people who is my favorite people, we'll just leave it at that, is Toby Cosgrove. In my book, I wanted to read this to you before I showed you this. Toby Cosgrove is really greater neighborhood than a community. He's a cardiothoracic surgeon, probably the best in the world, or not. He is at the chair of cardiothoracic surgery at the Cleveland Clinic, which many of you may know is always number one in the U.S. Regional Report. He has about 18 or 19 patents. I just hope that the next year he gets a new one, so I think we're talking about. But he's also very dyslexic. And in my book, I'm writing about how he struggled to learn to read throughout his early schooling. In college, he said, French was almost the end of me as I worked my butt off to obtain 3D minuses and D in medium French. Reading, writing a paper, or giving a talk became big problems. The young Toby college man once stopped work. Quote, all I did was study, even on weekends. While everyone else was partying or going to movies and sports events, I packed my suitcase and left the home where I studied all weekend. But what happened? He's dyslexic, right? He didn't do very well as a college admission test. So what happened? He was rejected by 12 of 13 medical schools. Thankfully, he was accepted by one. And as they say, the rest is history. We were very fortunate to be invited to the Cleveland Clinic and give a joint talk with him, where he talked passionately about his early struggles and about the teachers and tutors who have made such a difference in his life. Not too long ago, he called and he said, oh, I have great news. I said, what's that? He said, well, I'm now the appointed CEO of the Cleveland Clinic. I'm not that, I should add, and in my book I write about it, he could stop a patient's heart 5-6 times a day and perform surgery, not even twice. You know when he has a heart? When after the procedure, he has to put on the intercom and speak to the patient's family and pronounce their names. He says he very often mispronounces their names, and the nurses in the OR invariably giggle, there he goes again. So you can see on the one hand, the pathologic weakness, on the other hand, brilliance. So he was made head of the Cleveland Clinic. And what's so very nice is he asked if I speak to the board of the Cleveland Clinic dealer, which I did. And this is what she sent me, what she read, and I love the headline. From C&Ds to CEO, at the age of 63, Delos Toby Cosgrove, surgeon, inventor, go-to guy, and dyslexic, takes the helm of the Cleveland Clinic. And I just want to read what I had written about him, because I think it summarizes Dr. Cosgrove and other alike. Even after being rejected by 12 of 13 medical schools, being told he was the worst resident in his class at Massachusetts General Hospital, and being strongly advised not to go into cardiothoracic surgery, he didn't give up, nor did he recite his dream. By now, Cosgrove has been offered the position of chair of surgery at just about every one of the schools that rejected him. And yes, now it's his turn. He turned each one of them down. So, what do we take from this? There are several. One is that dyslexia is a clinical diagnosis. It's not by story at below a certain point in a single test. What's important is we as physicians teach our aspiring physicians history is so important. So a diagnosis is clinical. It's based on a clinician's knowledge, based on history and observations, not cutoff scores. You have to keep in mind test scores you develop to the proxies, the reality of life of that person's experience. Demonstrate is really what counts. The need is urgent, so what can be done? Well, we each in our own way can try to make a difference. What we're doing it now, I'm very excited to tell you, we've now established in Yale, the Yale Center for Dyslexia and Creativity. Our tagline is slow reading out of the box today. And we want to make sure that people appreciate that. We just put their website for parents and teachers. And others. And what we want to be able to do is have to be a place that parents, teachers, and dyslexic
the work progress, and here are some of the people who weren't as well, say, architects, people in the entertainment world, the Boston Children's Hospital, and our mission is to transform dyslexia from a liability to an asset. We formed two major initiatives. One is the initiative to build a possible. The initiative for the practical application of scientific advances in dyslexia. We want to do very powerful dissemination. Because I've heard in just a short time we've been here, the frustration some of the good people have that all the science is not being brought into practice. So this will be one way of doing it. We're doing a whole bunch of other things as well. And also to have an initiative for cancer surgeons. Let's study this relationship between dyslexia and creativity. This is my favorite cartoon, as some of you may know. It says, non-disciplinaries have to take a shot. It's also a sense that dyslexia children and adults are like these non-disciplinaries. And it's been our hope and our dream that now with all this wonderful new scientific knowledge, if dyslexic children want to take a good shot, God bless them. And if they want to be doctors and educators, policymakers, or stay-at-home mothers, they should be able to do that as well. You can't see it, but these are the wonderful people who are responsible for us being here from the Woolbridge School and also from and we want to just express our really genuine appreciation that they are dynamics. And they think, well, here we are in Madison. We may not know what they know of the rest of the country. I can genuinely and honest tell you they know more than most people do anywhere else in the country. So you are very fortunate to have, and as I've told them, I want to keep in touch with them. And again, I'll be happy to do a book signing for any of those who would like to very shortly next year, I understand. So again, we have to acknowledge who pays the bills, and that's the National Institute of Health. And thank you all for your long period of inclusion and retention. It's been absolutely spectacular. So thank you for having us, and thank you for the institutional attention. Mostly, thank you for your attention.
Thank you so much.